All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming. I'm actually introducing a man who no longer needs introduction. You're all here for Jamie Shea, and today this lecture is about terrorism. Jamie.
Anthony, thanks again, and thanks, as always, on these occasions to you personally and to the Institute for hosting us, and I'm very grateful also to the audience for coming today. I realise that it's exam time, or if you're not doing exams, you're probably thinking about Christmas celebrations and Christmas turkey. International terrorism is probably the thing that you want to least think about this time of the year, and for good reason. So I'm very grateful to you for being here. As Anthony said, we're now, with this lecture, reaching the halfway stage of the series of six lectures on new threats and challenges in the 21st century. And today, as you know, I'd like to talk about something which has been much talked about over the last 6 or 7 years. It's really been the defining challenge so far in the 21st century. And that, of course, is international terrorism. Since 9/11 and the attacks against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in the United States, which killed nearly 3,000 people, as you recall, the Western countries have really put this almost at the top of their agenda. Only now do we really see terrorism as a preoccupation becoming displaced by issues such as climate change, which I spoke on last time, or energy security or proliferation or other things. Now, the first thing, of course, is that terrorism is not really a 21st century topic at all. It's been in existence for thousands of years already. The assassins were, in fact, a group in the ancient world, in Babylon, also the Sicarii in the Middle East, which operated hundreds of years before the birth of Christ. And those of you who, like me, have studied your history will know that terrorist movements have appeared off and on for the last centuries in different forms, usually linked to nationalist and national liberation movements. My country, the United Kingdom, has had a long experience, as you know, with Irish Republican terrorist organisations and Irish Protestant organisations as well. And the first attack by what today we call the Irish Republican Army, but which used to be called the Irish Republican Brotherhood, was against a prison in London, Clerkenwell Prison, in 1867. You could perhaps also call the Russian anarchists who assassinated Tsar Nicholas I, terrorists. And indeed, if you really want to look at the most spectacular terrorist action so far in human history, it's probably the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria-Hungary in Sarajevo on the 28th of June 1914 by the young Serbian Black Hand movement. If the aim of terrorism is to cause massive destruction and disruption, I don't think anything really beats the 10 million dead of the First World War. At the same time, though, because the classic terrorism that we've had to confront was usually linked to national liberation movements in specific territorial areas, and the terrorism did not go much beyond those territorial areas, we've also seen the strange phenomena of many former terrorist leaders ending up as respectable prime ministers and presidents and statesmen. For example, one thinks of Menachem Begin in Israel, who was behind the Stern Gang that blew up the King David Hotel, where British forces were stationed in Jerusalem in 1946, or the president of Ireland, Éamon de Valera, throughout the interwar period, who grew up in the ranks of the IRA. Even Yasser Arafat, at the head of the PLO organisations, lived long enough to become the legitimate head of the Palestinian Authority. Now, that said, why today do we believe that international terrorism has become more significant or more threatening or more dangerous than in the past? Why has it gone, if you like, from a local problem that certain countries have with particular national movements, for example, the Basques in Spain or Irish Republicanism or other movements such as the Palestinian cause? Why has it mutated into a global issue which has global outreach and which all of us, wherever we live, have to be frightened of or threatened by and feel responsible for reacting against? Well, I think the first reason, of course, is that we live today now increasingly in urban environments. A few years ago, the UN recorded for the first time that the majority of people live in cities rather than in villages or the countryside. We depend increasingly on highly sophisticated, just-in-time delivery supply networks. We rely upon electronics more and more for every aspect of our professional and even our personal lives. And so globalization has made terrorism a more attractive activity by groups that believe that it is the weapon of the weak against the strong, because globalization has generated more targets and made it easier for even comparatively small attacks to achieve disproportionate impacts. If one thinks, for example, of the 9/11 attacks of Al-Qaeda against the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, experts believe that the organisation of those attacks, although highly impressive, cost no more than $250,000. Joseph Stiglitz, in his book The Trillion Dollar War, which came out already 2 years ago, calculated that by then the American response to the 9/11 attacks had cost the American taxpayer $1.4 trillion. And the latest estimate that I have seen, which goes up to 2011, is that the cost of responding, both in terms of homeland security, in terms of the US operation in Iraq, the current NATO-US operations in Afghanistan, that by 2011, the cost will be up in the region of $2 trillion and rising. In other words, the response to the attacks on 9/11 will have cost about the same as the United States spent confronting the Soviet Union for the 50 years after 1945 throughout the Cold War period. That is why Osama bin Laden has spoken of economic jihad, the notion that this is an extremely cost-effective way of getting the West's attention for certain causes. The other aspect, of course, of globalisation is not only has it made us more vulnerable, but it's greatly increased the ability of terrorists to organise and to carry out attacks. For example, the internet. A lot of attention has gone onto madrasas, the religious schools in places like Pakistan, where young Muslims are deemed to be radicalised by being given a very severe religious, very narrow education. Those schools do exist and no doubt have played a role in radicalisation and recruitment. But the internet now means that all recruitment, all radicalisation could take place purely online without anybody ever having to go to a madrasa. The Canadians have a very effective security intelligence service which has calculated that young Islamists need only spend 10 days between first going on to these websites through empathy, then to sympathy, and finally the decision to become actively involved in the planning of execution attacks. In other words, what used to take years can now be narrowed down into 10 days. And in fact, the head of the British, the former head of the British Metropolitan Police, Sir Ian Blair, no relation to Tony Blair, Sir Ian Blair, who was in charge of the British reaction to the July 25 attacks on the London Underground, you remember though, his study of a group that in 2006 planned another spectacular attack. Fortunately, this one never took place, but it was an attack against seven airliners, some British, some American, that would be in the air at the same time, crisscrossing the Atlantic using liquid explosives in shampoo bottles, that the perpetrators of those attacks, and the last one, by the way, was convicted in a court in London only yesterday, that they had been, they'd gone from being normal people to becoming terrorists in a matter of weeks, all through internet recruitment. In other words, those form of electronic media today allows messaging, allows propaganda, allows the transmission of know-how, expertise, particularly in terms of making explosives, planning attacks, engaging in secret encoded communications on the website, and then finally to the planning and organisation of actual attacks. So something which, of course, most of you as students will probably think is a great tool of liberation in terms of a walk, being able to carry just with a BlackBerry a kind of instant encyclopedia into all human knowledge. That force for good, of course, also has its dark side as well. And this has allowed a new phenomenon, which is that of the global terrorist network, exemplified in Al-Qaeda. In other words, as I said, earlier terrorist movements tended to be linked to nationalist movements in limited areas. They basically did not recruit outside their own immediate compatriots or very local affairs. They were mainly family affairs, by the way. A great deal of recruiting in the Irish Republican Army was done basically within families that passed the Republican tradition on from uncle to nephew or to niece or to father, son, grandfather to grandson. But the globalisation has allowed now a franchising. Al-Qaeda, which existed originally in Africa in the beginning of the 1990s, now has an Al-Qaeda Central, which we believe is somewhere in Balochistan or the federal tribal areas of North Pakistan. But it also has Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Sahel, and Somalia in Africa, and now is now an Al-Qaeda of the Maghreb as well. So below the Al-Qaeda Central, which still exists with Osama bin Laden and his deputy Zahawiri still at large, below that you have a group which is Al-Qaeda directed and inspired, the sort of sub-branches, and then you have a third level, which is deemed to be the group that carried out the attacks on the London Underground in 2005, who had never been known to the police before, as I've said, which had no direct links, but which was Al-Qaeda inspired. In other words, they took their inspiration as well as some of the know-how from the Al-Qaeda web sites. And 9/11 is typical of that. It was an attack which was financed in Asia, which was recruited and planned essentially in Spain and Germany, in Europe, and then, of course, which was carried out in the United States itself. The globalisation of financial flows, as well as the internet, allowed terrorists now to recruit well beyond their immediate catchment areas. And this is not just, by the way, religious or Islamist type of terrorism. For example, one of the more dangerous organizations, in my opinion, in recent years, was the Onshinrinko Japanese cult. Although it was global, at its height, when you remember it released sarin gas on the Tokyo underground network, killing 11 people some years ago. At its height, it had 60,000 members and a budget of $1 billion and was actively attempting to acquire weapons of mass destruction. Now, there is some debate, of course, among terrorist experts as to whether Al-Qaeda as an organisation still essentially controls and directs the global operation, or whether, frankly, the American response in Iraq and Afghanistan since 9/11 has created a situation where Osama bin Laden isn't directing anything any longer. He's essentially in hiding, hoping that he's not going to be spotted by an American drone flying over Pakistan, and that therefore the groups are now autonomous. I don't know the answer to that basic question. The experts differ. But what we do know is that Al-Qaeda is still very much there, very much in existence. The fact that there has not been a spectacular since 9/11 should not make us think for one minute that these groups are not actively plotting. The problem is that, you know, the failures get the publicity and the intelligent successes, it's in the nature of intelligence to be discreet, don't get any publicity at all. But those who study terrorism will know that since 9/11, that Al-Qaeda has plotted a whole series of spectacular attacks. I mentioned the seven airliners of 2006. There was also a plot to blow up the fuel pipeline system at John F. Kennedy Airport in 2007. A major attack against Frankfurt Airport in 2007, also frustrated by intelligence. In fact, the former director of MI5 in the United Kingdom, Stella Rimington, would regularly give interviews saying that her agency was plotting at any one time 3,000 British citizens of Pakistani origin who had been in Pakistan attending terrorist training camps, and between 200 and 300 terrorist plots which were being planned at any one time, and that's in my country, the United Kingdom, alone. So there is absolutely no room here for any kind of complacency. At the same time, we also now see a new kind of terrorism, which is a terrorism whose level of ambition is greatly greatly exceeds anything that we saw with the old nationalist groups seeking the liberation of a small portion of the world's territory. For example, if you look at Al-Qaeda, it has not one aim, but five. First of all, and this is, I'm quoting here from Al-Zahawiri, the deputy to Osama bin Laden, the eviction of the Jewish Crusader Alliance from Muslim lands. That was the radical separation of the Islamic world or the Muslim countries from others. Number two, which is almost like undoing globalization. Number two, the deposition of corrupt apostate governments such as the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia across the Muslim world. The imposition of Sharia Islamic law, the restoration of the Caliphate, a single Islamic nation which has gone since the demise of the Ottoman Empire. And finally, the destruction of what he calls Zionist Israel. This has led some experts to talk of a distinction between nationalist terrorism, which is negotiable. You may not like it. You obviously are not going to approve of its methods. But you can at least see that, for example, if the IRA converts into the political party Sinn Féin, some kind of ultimate compromise is possible. The terrorists can be brought in from the cold, as what is happening now with the Northern Irish peace process, and an end is in sight. But this has led some individuals to talk of a new kind of terrorism, which is called transformational or irrational terrorism. In other words, a terrorism whose level of ambition is so absurd, so exorbitant, so transformational in terms of our ability to negotiate on its particular demands that no political accommodation is possible. One, although I mentioned before Menachem Begin or Emin de Valera or Yasser Arafat or others, it's very difficult to believe that one day Osama bin Laden could convert himself into a respectable statesman in charge of a country wherever as possible. That said, we should be very careful, ladies and gentlemen, not to believe that all terrorism is of the jihadist, extreme Islamist type, although the focus has been on that. Robert Pape, let me just pick up my notes here. Robert Pape, who is one of the foremost American experts, reminds us that 50% of suicide attacks are not carried out by radical Islamist groups, but by others. And there are many others. We have had until recently one of the most deadly in the world, which was the Tiger Liberation Movement of Tamil Eelam, the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. We have had also the PKK, which has given a lot of grief to Turkey over the years. There is the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, which is Christian inspired. So other religions also pop up in some of these movements. We've had the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades of the Palestinians and many others. And the existence, of course, of the Basque separatist ETA in Spain shows that even defeating the nationalist movements continues to be very difficult indeed. That said, the trend lines are not particularly favourable. In 1993, there were only 9 recorded suicide attacks. 2005, 350, And 2006, the last year for which I have figures available, about 250 attacks. So there's been a sharp rise in terrorist attacks. And between 1998 and 2006, there were 24,187 recorded terrorist attacks in the world, claiming just under 39,000 victims. Although, interestingly, if you compute the average, it works out at 1.6 fatalities per attack. So most of the attacks, in fact, have not caused life loss of life on the scale of 9/11. But and indeed, it also has to be said that the vast majority of the attacks are in certain areas like Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan. This has led some terrorist scholars, again, quoting Robert Papp, the American, to conclude that terrorism is essentially linked to or what he calls areas of occupation, in other words, where international forces are deemed by terrorists to be occupying their territory. Still, even if Robert Pape has a point, we are dealing with a global phenomenon. So, ladies and gentlemen, what is terrorism? A fundamental question. But we still don't have an internationally accepted definition of terrorism, although we're quite close. And there are still many people who believe, to paraphrase Ronald Reagan of a few years ago, that one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. This is what Yasser Arafat argued when he spoke at the UN General Assembly back in 1974. Other scholars have been prepared to sort of understand, in inverted commas, terrorism if they believe that no democratic recourse is possible. In other words, terrorism is bad in states where there are democratic means to redress grievances, but it could be, so they say, understandable where there are no democratic recourses. I think if we start making a distinction between good terrorism and bad terrorism, frankly, we are going to be on a very, very slippery slope very, very quickly. And therefore, I think it's extremely important that we condemn any act where innocent civilians are the target, not just the byproduct, but the target of an attack, and that we don't resort to double standards by saying that my kind of terrorism is fine and your kind of terrorism is bad. All terrorism is to be condemned, and therefore it's just as important that Israel condemns an Israeli terrorist who shoots Palestinians as Israel would condemn a Palestinian terrorist who shoots Israelis. What we do know, however, is first, terrorism is politically inspired. In other words, it's not just an act of rage. You know, the guy who goes out with the gun into the US Army base or the US schools or anywhere else and shoots people. There has to be a political inspiration. It has to be to serve a political objective, even if, as I said, the political objective is a rather amorphous one. Secondly, civilians have to be the targets, not serving military officers, for example. I'm not saying that they cannot be victim of a terrorist attack, but terrorism as such targets directly civilians who are not caught up directly in a conflict. Third, and this is in dispute, but I believe that terrorism has to use actual violence. I therefore don't believe in cyber terrorism. Yes, I believe in cyber sabotage, and we will have a lecture on this next year as part of my series. I believe, you know, in cyber security. Yes, but I think that terrorism has to be an act of physical violence, not just turning off a switch or hacking into a computer. Fourthly, terrorism, as I said, is the arm of the weak against the strong. And therefore, I do not believe that it aims to defeat an enemy. Al-Qaeda cannot defeat NATO in Afghanistan or the United States. The differential in terms of power is simply too great. But the aim of terrorism is to sort of inspire resistance, as they see it, and to send a political message. The next one, number four, number five, is that the act has to have symbolic significance. So the World Trade Center, the symbol of Western capitalism, the Pentagon, the symbol of American power, these are carefully chosen. Next, I think it's very important that terrorism be seen as a sub-state activity. In other words, can you have a terrorist state? Well, no, you can have an aggressive state. Nazi Germany certainly comes into that category. But terrorism is normally an activity of sub-states. In other words, maybe they want to be a state or they have some other thing. A cause, they could even be supported by a state they could get weapons from a state, but normally these are sub-state actors, although some of them, by the way, are powerful, because we often look upon a terrorist organisation as being a group of individuals with limited means. But if you look at the Tamil Tigers, the LTTE in Sri Lanka, they had tanks, they had aircraft, they had artillery. They could go from actually being a conventional fighting force to actually being a terrorist organisation. And suicide bombers were invented by the Tamil Tigers, by the way, not by Al-Qaeda or anybody else. Finally, I believe that in defining terrorism, the act is not so much intended to appeal, or not to appeal, but to impact on the adversary. The act is more intended to mobilise one's own community. Palestinian terrorists normally record videos before they commit the act of suicide bombing. And they do that to show that, you know, to encourage, to motivate their community, to show that they are organising some act of resistance. So terrorism, as I say, is used to sort of mobilise one's own supporters more than to affect the judgment of an adversary. I think if you're going to deal with terrorism, ladies and gentlemen, it's very important to understand what it is and what it isn't, right from the very beginning. Next, who are the terrorists? Well, I cannot obviously give you some kind of police standardised sort of portrait of the typical terrorist. Probably that person does not exist. But research does tend to indicate the following. A disaffected individual, somebody who obviously does not feel at ease in society. For example, in the United Kingdom, it's often been individuals who are second-generation immigrants, for example, who don't feel sufficiently close to the original culture because they were born in the United Kingdom, but don't feel as if they have integrated into Britain either. They feel sort of on the margins of society. Often they act in order to gain renown, to become famous, to do something which is going to give their lives meaning and mean that they will be remembered afterwards in their community. Secondly, we know that terrorists don't just become terrorists like that. You need an enabling group. You need a group that gradually supports that person's inclination to commit a terrorist act. Often that form of indoctrination or training or preparation can last for a while. There has to be, as I say, a political cause or a legitimizing ideology. Terrorists, to the extent the research tells us anything, tend to have a very black and white view. That's not to say they're silly. They're not. The perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks had master's degrees in engineering. Nearly all of them came from middle class Saudi or Egyptian families. But they had a very black and white view of who is right, who is wrong. They were very certain of their view of the world. The next is that there is a desire for revenge. What is very clear of all terrorists who have been interviewed is this idea of being on the defensive. That, you know, they are under pressure. The United States is occupying their land, or they have suffered humiliation. They are the underdog. They are the victim. And therefore, the act of terrorism is a desire for revenge, a desire to show that they are responding. That said, though, a number of terrorist Al-Qaeda, and this is, again, a big difference from the old IRA, ETA, nationalist form of terrorism, is parasitical. Al-Qaeda does not have really so much a political project of its own, but tends to sort of hijack other people's causes in order to get more of a global anger going. So one minute they talk about Guantanamo and the way in which Muslims are being treated there. This is in the past, or Abu Ghraib, you remember, a few years ago in Iraq, or the Palestinian problem, or the way in which UN sanctions against Iraq a few years ago during the days of Saddam Hussein led apparently to the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children, or the problems of collateral damage, as we say, caused by NATO airstrikes in Afghanistan. So whatever sort of cause is out there, which is likely to sort of aggravate the gulf between, they see it, the Muslim communities and the rest, they play on. They have not so much a political project of their own, but where they can exacerbate. So, ladies and gentlemen, can terrorism be defeated? This is a difficult one. The lesson of history would tend to say no, it's probably something that's always going to be there. Even when we think we have defeated it, it tends to rear up and give us a nasty shock. In my country, the UK, a year or so ago, everybody was very upbeat about the Northern Irish peace process. Former IRA figures such as Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness are now in the government. We have had an extraordinary amount of reconciliation. And yet a few months ago, a British policeman was shot by a Republican group outside a barracks, a car bomb outside the Parliament building in Belfast. It didn't go off, thank God, but was discovered a few weeks ago. There is always a splinter group out there. We had the IRA and then the provisionals and then the real IRA and so on. Just like Spain, which has gone to extraordinary lengths, as all of you know, over the years to come up with a federal structure, decentralised. The Basques have a great deal of autonomy, more than many other provinces of countries in the European Union. Their language is respected and so on. But even these enormous overtures don't seem to be enough to flush out all remaining elements. So one has to be cautious. And even those who claim a military victory, like the Sri Lankans, now believe that they have militarily defeated the LTTE over the last couple of months, have to ask themselves the question, is if you defeated or you think you've defeated a terrorist organisation militarily, but then you don't follow up with overtures to the community, the Tamils, to integrate them into political life. Well, you may think that you've won a military victory, but a few years down the road, the group may come back. So clearly, if you look at what we call coercion theory, you need a balanced approach. The experts call coercion theory, or strategic coercion, something which consists, A, of denial. You've obviously got to keep the terrorists on the run. Don't give them time to organise, obviously. Arrest them, harass them totally, which is what the United States is doing with Al-Qaeda today on the frontier between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But you've also got to do two other things to be successful. You've got to reduce the local support for the terrorists, and you've got to reduce the international support for the terrorists. The UK started to have some luck with the IRA a few years ago when we effectively persuaded the United States administration to clamp down harder on gun running activities and fundraising and so on, which was taking place in sympathetic Irish nationalist circles in the United States. So you've got to do those three things. So, ladies and gentlemen, how ultimately, therefore, can we win or at least succeed enough to make terrorism something which is not a strategic threat to us? Well, I think the first thing is to have a defensible and achievable goal. Mussolini famously declared a war on flies. I'm not sure if any of you have been to Italy for the summer holidays, but did you see some flies? Yes? So Mussolini's war on flies didn't succeed. It's a noble but unrealisable objective. And therefore to declare, as some people have done since 9/11, that the aim is to eradicate evil from the world, or a war on evil, or a global war on terrorism, are obviously declaring war on an abstraction. And you can't declare war on an abstraction. You can aim to defeat terrorist groups, dismantle them, disrupt them, but you can't really defeat terrorism as such. So we have to have a defensible and achievable goal. And we have to distinguish between strategic success and tactical success. The Bush administration, for example, had enormous success at capturing or even removing, if I can use that word, from the scene, the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks. Within about a year, 25% of those responsible for 9/11 had been apprehended. not bad. But of course, as Dom Rumsfeld, you remember Dom Rumsfeld, as he famously argued in a memo, if the methods that the United States was using were simply encouraging more recruitment of terrorists, you know, for everyone arrested, five were joining the cause, were you really succeeding in the long run? So it's very important when you deal with terrorism to measure what is significant and not just what looks good on TV. Have defensible goals. You may have to do things that you don't particularly like doing as well, which is giving an amnesty to terrorists if they are people who can be, if you like, changed into normal citizens, which is something that the Saudis have invested a great deal in. Of course, the hardcore, those who will never be converted, have to be put behind bars, obviously. But you cannot really defeat a terrorist movement in the long run if you cannot convert or co-opt a great majority back into a political solution. I think the next way to deal with it is to stick to our values and our principles. Benjamin Franklin, he once said, "Those who would give up an essential liberty for temporary security deserve neither liberty nor security." And I think he's right. One of the things that really does play into the hands of terrorists is the idea of double standards, that, you know, we preserve the life of our own people, but we disregard the life of Muslims, for example, caught up in battle zones. We count our own casualties, but we don't count their casualties, as if human life is not equal. We have to be very careful that we do not feed terrorist propaganda by using undemocratic methods ourselves. And that's been the whole argument about Abu Ghraib and extraordinary rendition and, as you know, the whole question of what kind of methods can you use to interrogate terrorist suspects. We have to measure the gains against the costs in this respect, which is, I think, one of the reasons why President Obama took the decision on the first day that he was in office to close Guantanamo. And now, even though this is controversial in the United States, to insist that terrorists be tried in civilian courts through the normal American system. After all, the perpetrators of the attacks against the World Trade Center, you remember in 1993, some of you may be too young to remember this, but there was an attack against the World Trade Center in 1993, 8 years before the really spectacular one. And the perpetrators of that were actually successfully tried in the American civil court system. So it can be done. So stick to our principles, stick to our values. Then you must know your enemy. We have a habit to think that terrorists are crazies, that they're psychopaths, that they're mad, that they have no reason, in their view, rational reason, to be terrorists. But I like Dostoevsky on this. I think you can learn a lot from Dostoevsky, the greatest Russian writer. If you've ever read his Notes from Underground, there is a phrase which has struck me all my life. It says, while nothing is easier than to denounce the evil doer, nothing is more difficult than to understand him. And terrorists do believe that they have a rational reason for acting the way they do. And we need to understand that if we're going to be successful in dismantling terrorist networks. One way is to penetrate their organisations. The UK got very good at penetrating the IRA. Eventually, 70% of planned attacks by the IRA were cancelled because they knew that they had been penetrated by the British intelligence service. Be careful about prisons. We have evidence that a large number of terrorists were recruited in prisons. Prisons are not just the University of Organised Crime, they're also the University of Terrorism. John Walker Lind, Australian, picked up in Afghanistan. Joseph Padilla, the famous perpetrator of the radiological bomb, the dirty bomb, picked up in Chicago. Richard Reed, the famous shoe bomber, you remember, the person who had the bomb in the shoe, all recruited in prison. So we have to be very careful that we try to get inside the terrorist networks intellectually. Not just destroy them, but get inside them. For example, some people even believe that we should negotiate with terrorists such as Louise Richardson, who is the principal of St Andrews University, very famous American expert on terrorism. She argues that negotiation is a good way of gathering intelligence on terrorist organisations, because when you negotiate with them, you understand their strengths and weaknesses, even their internal divisions, better than if you don't talk to them at all. We have to separate terrorists from their communities. Mao Zedong said that the guerrilla fighter is like a fish in the sea. And terrorists need a very major support network of active and passive sympathisers, safe houses, money laundering and so on, in order to operate. And therefore, it's very important that representatives, for example, of moderate Muslim communities or others speak out against terrorists and make it clear that they do not represent, they're not legitimate representatives of that community. That message is far better coming from the head of a Muslim mosque in London than it is coming from a Christian or other member or a Hindu or whatever member of the British government. We have to separate the terrorists from their community. Then also, and I'm almost finished, we have to engage others in countering terrorists with us. This is not something where we can succeed alone. International cooperation is indispensable in exchanging data. For example, the Schengen arrangements of the European Union. You associate it with the fact that you can drive across the frontier between Belgium and the Netherlands at 200 kilometres an hour in the middle of the night, which I never do, of course. Passport-free travel. But if you are in the security area, you identify Schengen with a great deal of data exchange, a linked-up computer system of the police and the intelligence services in the European Union. The EU has a common arrest warrant, so which facilitates the paperwork. It used to be the case that French terrorists in Britain could not be extradited because the paperwork simply was too complicated and too incompatible. That, I'm glad to say, is now over. A common arrest warrant, extradition agreements, ability to jointly track money laundering and money flows, and, of course, transportation. So international cooperation is vital. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as I come to the end, I think the key thing, though, is a slogan of Britain during World War II: keep calm and carry on, which was used to be up in every air raid shelter in the Blitz during World War II. And today I think we would sort of say, have patience and keep your perspective. As Michael Howard, a great British commentator, has said, to wage war on terror requires secrecy, intelligence, political sagacity, quiet ruthlessness, but also infinite patience. There's no quick fix solution, but we have to keep it in proportion. 17,000 Americans die of traffic accidents every year. Far more people than are killed in terrorist acts. So keep a sense of proportion. First thing, why is there more crime today? Easy. There are more things to steal. Criminals 50 years ago didn't have mobile phones, high-speed cars, laptop computers, digital cameras. You know, the whole consumer society means there's more things to steal. And as I've said, there are more terrorist targets to attack. So this is going to remain attractive for certain extremist groups. We have to develop social resilience, redundant electricity networks, redundant transportation networks. We have to achieve better coordination of our emergency rescue services so that attacks, if and when they occur, don't cause disruption, for example, in New York, shutting down the banking system on Wall Street for 6 days after 9/11. The quicker we are seen as responding to terrorist attacks, the less likely terrorists are to believe that they can achieve much by planning those attacks. But above all, and this is what I want to end on, we need to focus on the major threat of all, which is that terrorists could acquire weapons of mass destruction. What we've had so far have been attacks using aircraft, even box cutters. That was comparatively simple means. And we can recover from those kind of attacks. even though at the time they're truly spectacular. But one of the things that it would be so much more difficult to recover from would be a terrorist group using a radiological, biological weapon or a nuclear device. Although I'm not trying to conclude today by scaring you and convincing you that this is about to happen, nonetheless, it's something that we have to take very seriously because it's so potentially catastrophic. There is evidence that Al-Qaeda has tried to acquire highly enriched uranium. Osama bin Laden tried to buy 8 kilograms of the stuff from the South Africans in 1992. Al-Qaeda had talks with Pakistani scientists involved in the nuclear program towards the end of the 1990s. The RAND Corporation and Western Intelligence Services calculate that about 43 kilograms of uranium have been stolen and trafficked since the Berlin Wall came down 20 years ago. And although a lot of this has actually been discovered in police sting operations, nobody knows if there's not more out there. And you only need about one third of that amount to produce a functioning nuclear bomb. So there is evidence that Al-Qaeda has been trying to get the know-how. For example, they had in Afghanistan at a place called Darunta, a training camp on chemical weapons, where they used dogs as guinea pigs to see to what degree the chemical weapons could work. We know very well that coming back to globalization, that they have employed PhD scientists, they've employed PhD computer hackers. As I said, don't believe that fanatics are coming from the uneducated areas of our society, far from it. One worry in particular is, you know, the expanse of biotechnology in the private sector today, which is one of the big growth areas. The fact that even government research institutes increasingly are looking at pathogens, the enormous amount of research that's going in now into diseases and epidemics, you know, like SARS and avian bird flu and so on. All of this, if you only have, like the man who was working in an American laboratory and who took anthrax out and organised the anthrax attacks in 2001, if you only have some kind of disgruntled official who takes some of this biotechnology or these pathogens or whatever away and gives them to a terrorist organisation, you could have a weapon of mass destruction rather quickly. In fact, even, and forgive me for this pronunciation because I'm not a chemist, but even thioglycol, which apparently is what you use to for the ink in your ballpoint pens, acquired in sufficient quantities, is an extremely powerful chemical weapon. So, in a nutshell, while we cannot hope to prevent every kind of terrorist attack, or always know in advance, we have to sort of focus our efforts on the area which could be most potentially catastrophic to us, which would be, as George Bush once said, and here I think George W. Bush was right, what would happen if the worst weapons got into the hands of the worst people. That's not to give you nightmares for this evening, but remember there is something about terrorist organisations which makes dealing with terrorism very difficult. And this was encapsulated by the IRA when they tried to blow up Margaret Thatcher. Again, some of you at the back are nodding, which means you're almost of my generation. Others, if you are looking nonplussed. But in the 1980s, the IRA tried to blow up Margaret Thatcher during the Conservative Party conference in Brighton. And they didn't blow her up, but they injured quite a few other members of the Conservative cabinet. And afterwards, they, in a rather cynical telephone call, they said, well, you know, you have to succeed all the time. In other words, in stopping us. We only have to succeed once. So this is an incredibly asymmetric type of threat. Well, you know, we have to be vigilant all the time, never sleeping, 24 hours a day, you know, joining up the intelligence, crossing the T's, dotting the I's, making sure that, you know, our domestic intelligence is working with our external intelligence, is working with the police, that the information is going across borders. Yet these guys can fail and fail and fail and fail again but still achieve what they see as their objective purely by being lucky on one occasion. And that asymmetry means that, as I've said, this is going to be a very tempting form of action for the malcontents of the world, and therefore the best we can do is to contain terrorism rather than hope to ultimately and completely defeat it. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions, if there are any.
You've been talking a lot about asymmetrical warfare and the role of intelligence services and police agencies. And how do you see the role of NATO in fighting this asymmetrical relation?
I'm glad you asked me that because, of course, coming from NATO, I should have obviously spoken about the role of NATO, but I realised I was running out of time. So I'm really grateful. And I can assure the audience this question has not been planned in advance. No money has been transferred to this lady. But thank you for the question. I think that NATO's role is quite limited in terrorism. And I say this without any guilt or shame. I don't think NATO, to be relevant, has to show that it can play a major role on every issue, you know, climate change, proliferation, cyber, whatever. No, there are certain issues which fit NATO's capabilities better than others. Now, I think, and I think it's clear from what I've said, that terrorism is essentially an issue for the intelligence agencies, anticipating attacks, stopping them, sharing information, the police, obviously monitoring terrorist suspects, even home offices, ministries of the interior, which work on radicalization or de-radicalization, you know, re-education, reinsertion programs, working, for example, in my country with the moderate Muslim organizations in order to get them to sort of send a message of moderation and tolerance and multi-ethnicity. I mean, this is much more important than the military role. That said, there are, of course, things that NATO is doing and maybe even could do better. I mean, one, of course, is that you can make the argument, and I think NATO people will make the argument, that what we're doing in Afghanistan today, hopefully by creating a viable state there, viable governing structure, makes it impossible for Al-Qaeda and the extreme Taliban to come back. I say extreme Taliban because hopefully some of the Taliban can be absorbed into a ultimate political settlement in Afghanistan. But what the one thing I don't think anybody wants is that NATO leaves Afghanistan, it once again becomes a failed state, a black hole, where terrorist training camps come back as they did before 9/11. So you can make the argument that these sort of nation-building exercises are part of the international struggle against terrorism. You can't just wait to be attacked at home. You have to try to cut it out at source where you can. In other words, you mustn't give terrorist sanctuaries. That's the last thing you want to be able to do. The second thing I think that the alliance can do is policing the seas. A lot of worry today is focused on terrorists using the seas, first of all, to ship weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, radiological weapons, missile components, or even terrorists. And we have had since 2001 in the Mediterranean an operation called Active Endeavour. Even the Russians participate in this, non-NATO countries, which attempts to sort of monitor shipping to see if ships are being used potentially for terrorist activity. Now, I don't want to call pirates terrorists. I don't think pirates are, because they don't have a political motive. Pirates have a commercial motive. You know, it's not ideology that drives them. It's the prospect of a $2 million ransom and buying a house or a sports utility vehicle when they get home. But still, you know, we all have an interest in law and order on the oceans as well as on land. And what NATO, I think, also can contribute to is this idea of multinational maritime task forces, which can prevent, for example, terrorist attacks on shipping. They have happened. I mean, there have been terrorist attacks on oil tankers. One French oil tanker was targeted in the Persian Gulf a few years ago. Terrorists, for example, tried to blow up the Al Kaik petroleum refinery in Saudi Arabia. Okay, that was on land, but still. So the idea of protecting critical infrastructure where you have a big facility like a massive oil refinery, that's something where you need international cooperation, training. So there are lots of things that NATO can do. Another area, although this is slightly, this is more towards the weapons of mass destruction, is if a terrorist used a biological weapon, how would you know about it? The answer is you wouldn't. a chemical weapon, you know you're being attacked immediately. The poor British soldiers in the trenches during the First World War, when the mustard gas came over in 1915, they knew immediately that they were being attacked. Biological weapons, you don't. I mean, if I'm a terrorist and I use Q fever against you, for 6 weeks you're going to think you've just got influenza. And it's only after 6 weeks you're going to suddenly realise you've got something worse than influenza. So you need, therefore, military medicine to be able to do studies to very clearly identify if a weapon like that has actually been used, so that you can immediately start a programme of mass vaccination, for example, like anthrax. And NATO has been doing a lot of work in that area, which I think could be useful to the civilian authorities for emergency responses to particularly the use of biological weapons if terrorists get their hands on them. So, but let's not pretend that we are as important as the intelligence or the police services, because they're definitely in the front line. Yes, ma'am.
First, you said it, there are not terrorist countries. And how would you define countries that are governed by terrorist groups? And second, it's more of a remark than a question. I'm coming from Israel, and I would say that probably the main reason with terrorists why it's such a hard struggle is because of the public. Because every other thing, say global warming or a road accident, if the government say they want to do something or international community wants to do, so they can do it. But if it's about terrorism, so the public got so much emotions that they just, it's not going to be that much easy. If you don't want to put terrorists in prison or to do any other thing that will help the, I don't know, the environment or something, so the public is not going to let you do it so easily. And this is different than dealing death in road accident.
Yes, I do understand this because nothing outrages people more than the deliberate killing of innocent civilians. People who are young, for example, like in Tel Aviv, where a Palestinian group, you remember, blew up the discotheque, and you had lots of 18, you know, young people, probably just slightly younger than you, getting killed. And one experiences the sense of outrage and therefore the desire to hit back, you know, to strike back. An eye for an eye, you remember, like the Bible, a tooth for a tooth. I'm not saying that countries should not retaliate. For example, the United Nations was very clear after 2001 that the United States, having established that the attack came from Afghanistan, was perfectly entitled to retaliate against the Taliban in Afghanistan. Nobody disputed that for 1 minute. But I do believe that one also has to be careful, because the terrorists want the overreaction. That's what they're looking for. I mean, a terrorist act is specifically designed to elicit a massive response, which then, of course, naturally, immediately helps recruitment. For example, one has to be frank, and I say this as a deep friend of Israel, but nobody denies that Hezbollah was created after the Israeli incursion into the Lebanon in 1982. Again, it's this idea of resistance. So what I personally support was what Tony Blair did after the bombing in July 2005. When he was at Glen Eagles at the G8 summit meeting. Glen Eagles is in Scotland, and he came on TV and he gave a very measured, very moderate response. You know, he didn't sort of declare a counter sort of global war on terrorism. He didn't promise more than he could deliver. He spoke about the resilience of the British people, we would sort of go after the networks and all of that. That, you know, he praised the intelligence services for the bravery in rescuing people. And obviously, he did everything he could to precisely not to play into the hands of the terrorists by, you know, immediately declaring vengeance and provoking that counter-reaction that we're seeking. So, I personally think that the best thing is that of Roosevelt. Remember Teddy Roosevelt? Speak softly and carry a big stick. In other words, be very effective at dealing with terrorists. Be effective, yes, go after them. You remember, you've all seen the film Munich. Very good, you know, when you see exactly what Israel did in order to go after the perpetrators of the massacre of the Israeli Olympic team, you remember, in Munich in 1972. But you know, don't talk it up into, you know, some clash of civilizations or, you know, global war, because the terrorists want to be seen as warriors. You know, Osama bin Laden doesn't see himself as a terrorist. He sees himself as a noble warrior, a Saladin, you know, like the great heroes of the past. And to talk in their terms about, you know, jihad or war, clash of civilizations, that's precisely the propaganda victory, you know, ennobling their cause that they're seeking. So I totally understand the need to, you know, capture the people, to retaliate, but it's best to, you know, to be, as I say, talk less about it and make your action effective. That's the best answer I can give you on that one. Yes, sir.
Okay, my question deals more about maybe, looks a bit of sort of Afghanistan and terrorism. Jim Jones from the U.S. administration said recently in a television interview that there's only less than 100 operatives of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the link and other U.S. prominent politicians, as John McCain, have said that the Al-Qaeda is weaker than 10 years ago. And my question more also is that the question of, you mentioned or you stressed a number of times the objective of a terrorist attack is to mobilize its people. But when like something like Al-Qaeda gets smaller, don't they have a necessity to mobilize more people? And isn't the threat bigger now today than it ever been before?
Well, I think that Al-Qaeda is weaker today in terms of Al-Qaeda Central. That's to say the central organization. It's weaker today than it was before 9/11. Absolutely. The United States has managed to... what's the word? Well, yes, kill, I think, is the word. It has to be frank here. About 400 Al-Qaeda operatives in the Pakistani tribal areas. We don't have the exact statistics, through the use of intelligence and so on. And that certainly means that if you're Osama bin Laden, I think you're sort of permanently in hiding and going from one house to the other to escape arrest. And that doesn't give you much time to plan attacks. And keeping Al-Qaeda under pressure and on the run is, I think, a crucial part of being safe. But that said, one has to be very careful not to sort of always base oneself on yesterday's paradigm, because what I've tried to describe in my lecture today is a mutation of Al-Qaeda since 2011, away from being one single central organization, rather like a company, you know, with a hierarchy and thousands of people all in one place, Afghanistan, and more towards a kind of, you know, franchise where they give the brand, you know, they give the ideology via the internet, they give the do-it-yourself terrorist kit to all kinds of, you know, little groups that spring up very quickly and spontaneously, and which it's much more difficult for the police to apprehend. And as I mentioned, you know, there are now several Al-Qaedas. There are about six or seven. There was an Al-Qaeda in Iraq also until recently, when the leader, Zakari, as you know, was killed by the American forces. You know, if you've seen lately, for example, in terms of some of the activities in Saudi Arabia, you know, and all that, you realise that they have this ability to operate way beyond Pakistan. So in that respect, you've got to sort of see that this is an organisation which is very adaptable, very adaptable. As soon as one avenue is closed off, they find other ways. You know, just like in terms of attacks, if airlines become very, very secure, they then look at container traffic or they look at, you know, banks or Western interests or Western nationals. If they can't attack the United States, they try to attack Americans outside the United States, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So given that this is a type of threat which mutates and metamorphoses very quickly, we've got to make sure we have the agility that we're not going after yesterday's organization, if you like, but the reality of what it is today. The other thing, of course, is that although Al-Qaeda, its presence in Afghanistan has been reduced, as long as they have the sanctuary just over the border in Pakistan, fortunately it's not a sanctuary for them anymore, because the Pakistani army, as you know, has recently been much more active up in the tribal areas and in terms of attacking their bases and so on. But, you know, if you do allow them to have this sanctuary on the other side of the border, they could come back in Afghanistan in 5 minutes. So what did somebody say? Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, or something like that. But it means that, you know, as long as the potential is to come back very quickly, you can't declare that this is the final solution to the problem.
I just would like to have a very brief comment from you.
Yes,
I don't want to make the session too late. First of all, thank you for another brilliant exposition. What is your opinion on the latest news of this new code of jihad that was drafted on a Libyan high security jail of so-called reconverted terrorists? Have you seen anything on that in the BBC in the past 15 days?
No, I must confess I haven't, but there is some optimism in the region that you can in fact sort of convert sort of, as they call it themselves, jihadists, if you sort of put them back through some sort of educational system. I mean, the Saudis claim, I can't verify these statistics, but Saudi Arabia's devoted a lot. You know, they've been very tough on going after terrorists, but they've also been very clean on organising sort of re-education programmes. They claim that half of the terrorists in their jails have now been released, and they claim that only 1% have gone back to sort of radicalism as a result of the re-education programs that they've been through. I don't know. I mean, these sound very impressive figures, and I suppose you have to see it over a long-term period. But one of the things that everybody's very interested in is you know, what leads to radicalization. But on the other hand, also, how do you de-radicalize? Like, you know, with a drug addict, how do you sort of get a drug addict off drugs so that he doesn't have the doesn't want to go back on them again afterwards. I think, though, that one thing is pretty clear, and I'll give you a general answer here, is that there is a correlation between development, jobs, and terrorism. Now, I'm not naive, and I'm not arguing for one minute that Osama bin Laden became a terrorist because he was poor. Clearly not. You know, he very wealthy, and he financed not just the Al-Qaeda, but he actually financed Afghanistan for quite a long period of time out of his private fortune. So the leadership often do come from middle-class intellectual families. Absolutely true. But a lot of the foot soldiers clearly are doing it because their families have forced them to do so. That's the case for the Taliban, or because it pays more than being in the Afghan police, or because it's a job. If you look, in fact, I got some statistics. I didn't have a chance to give them in my lecture. But in the Arab world, the population in 1985 was 187 million. Today, it's 280 million. And it's calculated that by 2020, you know, just in 10 years, it's going to be 410 million. So almost double, in fact, more than double, in just over 30 years. 40% of that population will be under 14. So nearly half, you know, half will be under 20, or under 18. It's calculated, this is the World Bank statistics, that at the moment there are 15 million unemployed young people. That will then be, by the end of the next decade, 35 million. And the area will have to grow by at least 7% a year in order to absorb all of those unemployed young men. And if you believe in the testosterone factor, of sort of young people's frustration, then this is going to be disruptive. And so this is, I think, so I do believe that there is a development economic relationship between, you know, jobs, employment, the ability to get married, to have a normal life, and defeating radicalism. I'm not going to argue that, you know, creating the perfect society will not have terrorists. For example, in Germany in the 1970s, you had a very, very, very prosperous society, but you still had Baader-Meinhof, the Red Army faction. You still had disgruntled left-wing students who committed terrorist acts. But I think in terms of massive movements, definitely, you know, development, decreasing unemployment is going to make it more difficult for these people to recruit. Absolutely. So that's the best answer I can give you on that. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very grateful. Thanks again for coming today. Those of you who are still around next week, which may not be many given the university term, I'll be talking about energy security. It's very mild at the moment, so you're probably not very worried about energy security. But if it suddenly got very, very cold, you might get worried about it. So if you're still here, please come along next week. Thank you.